Now with a virtual world, we're actually able to engage with scientists from different parts of the world and then connect with their networks.
There has become sort of broad recognition that we have a responsibility in higher education to provide our PhD students with a broader set of skills and competencies.
That can be another way of getting information that you might not know.
You're listening to Vitamin PhD, a podcast from Boston University delivering career narratives and know-how to supplement your doctoral studies.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vitamin PhD podcast. This season, we're focusing on research skills. My name is Matt, and I'm a first-year PhD student in computer engineering here at BU.
And hello, listeners. My name is Heather, and I'm one of your hosts for this season of the Vitamin PhD podcast. And today, we're really excited to be chatting with Dr. Eden Medina, Associate Professor of Science, Technology, and Society at MIT, to discuss interdisciplinary research. We'll let her introduce herself now.
My name is Eden Medina. I am a professor of science, technology, and society at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The program that I am part of is defined by its interdisciplinarity. So it is a program that is that primarily consists of people who use methodologies from the humanities and social sciences to study phenomena in science and technology.
Awesome. That's so cool. As someone with an interdisciplinary background, I'm really curious about your approach to research. Can you tell us a little bit about what research means to you?
At a very basic level, research is an attempt to create new knowledge, to understand things that perhaps we haven't understood in the past, or to understand them in new ways. Within the university system, research is not only the pursuit of what we don't know or what we hope to understand better, it's also something that is conducted within a community of researchers. So it is, you know, you are working on your results, but your results are also in conversation and dialogue with people who are interested in similar kinds of questions, you know, and who are also evaluating and thinking about your work.
Oh, yeah, that was excellent. Thank you. I really like that idea of creating new knowledge. It's obvious in retrospect, but before you said that, I don't know that I really thought about it in those specific terms before. So with that in mind, let's turn to our challenge question. In 3 to 5 words, finish this sentence, please. Research is...
It is a mindset, and it is thinking about what drew you to your research topic, what excites you about it, why you think it's important.
Absolutely. I can definitely understand that, especially in these final stages of the dissertation. It's so important to remember what drew you to the topic and what was exciting about it to help push you to the finish line. And given your expertise as an interdisciplinary scholar, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to research?
I started in electrical engineering, so in signal and image processing. And, you know, that was very interesting for me. You know, it was very challenging as well. And there were not a lot of women in electrical engineering. In fact, we joked, you know, that there were more men named John in my year than there were women, to give you an idea. And so, you know, trying to understand my experience in tech, I started looking around campus to try to find other ways of understanding the kinds of technologies that I was working with and my experience with them. And serendipitously, I came across what was then called Women's Studies, and now is called Women and Gender Studies, and happened to take a course on gender and science that was taught by a historian of science. And it was in the course of that class that I started to see that scientific knowledge was not objective, that it, you know, it came out of a particular context, and often power relationships shaped that context. And, you know, that scientific knowledge changes over time in accordance to, you know, to context and practice, et cetera. And that was very enlightening for me. And it made me start to think not only about, you know, these kinds of relationships with respect to science, but with relation to technology. And, you know, today that's not surprising because there's so much work being done in areas such as computer ethics or artificial intelligence, thinking about how these kinds of systems are bound up in our world today. But, you know, back when I was an undergrad, there wasn't a lot of that going on specifically in electrical engineering departments. I finished my undergraduate degree. I started a master's degree in electrical engineering, but still was taking feminist theory and, you know, trying to make that work. And eventually I realized that, you know, what was interesting to me and kind of where I wanted to be with technology was not necessarily building it, but trying to understand the relationship of technology and social relationships and the kinds of societies that we were building. And so I was looking for graduate programs that would allow me to do that. And I applied actually to the program where I'm teaching today. So I applied to the program in science, technology, and society at MIT, born in Colombia. And I was looking at history of computing literature. And, you know, there wasn't a lot written about Latin America. Most of the history of computing literature was based on the United States, sometimes Europe, sometimes Japan. But as a region, Latin America wasn't really part of that conversation. So, you know, what had started as, you know, an attempt to think about gender and politics and power and relationship with technology actually shifted and became also a geographical interest. Like how, if we look at other parts of the world, how might that change our understandings of computing and the kinds of systems that we build and the kinds of societies that we create? So I became a Latin Americanist in addition to being a historian of computing. And so those are the two hats that I wear today. When people say, you know, what is your field? I say, oh, I wear two hats. I'm a historian of technology and I'm also a historian of Latin America.
Wow. Thank you for walking us through your entire journey there. It really speaks to the little interesting serendipities that can happen at any point in your journey. Even when you're headed down one path, any one class or professor can take you on a totally different journey. And that's something I can really relate to. When I decided I wanted to get into robotics and engineering, I told myself that I didn't really want to work in machine learning or AI, but now that's exactly where I'm focused. And that's all thanks to one professor and one class I took at the very end of my master's program. That class really showed me how AI is the future of robotics, at least in the applications that I'm interested in pursuing. So thinking about your journey and your dissertation in particular, how does it relate to the work you're doing today?
My earlier work looked at computing and a process of socialist revolution in Chile. And I was very interested in thinking about, you know, if we talk about computers as revolutionary technologies, let's see when they've been used, you know, as part of political revolution and let's see, you know, how that unfolds. And so that was a earlier project that grew out of my dissertation, and it became the book Cybernetic Revolutionaries, which was published by MIT Press. My current research is looking at a more contemporary period. So it's looking at the period from around 1989 to around 2014, and it's looking at when Chile returned to democracy. So it's like another period of political change and how science and technology forms part of that process. So in particular, I'm interested in efforts at truth and justice and reconciliation in the aftermath of human rights crimes. So during the Pinochet dictatorship, 3,200 people were disappeared or killed, as a result of the violence of the dictatorship. And when Chile returned to democracy, there was an effort to locate, identify the remains of those who had been disappeared as a way of having truth and also to return the remains to families for burial. And so I'm looking at how science and technology came in, you know, as a kind of solution to that problem. But the case that I'm looking at, actually, it doesn't turn out in the way that you might expect. So you might expect that, you know, new technologies would come in, scientific capabilities would come in, and that we would have some kind of identification and closure. But the case that I'm studying is a case of a large anonymous burial ground used by the military, where of the identifications that were made from that site, at least half were later shown to be wrong. So I'm interested in these moments where we have uncertainty, perhaps these moments are defined by their uncertainty, and we look to science and technology to give us answers. We want science and technology to give us the answers that we desire, but what happens if those answers are wrong? And what if we're in a really high stakes moment, like truth and justice and reconciliation, then what? Then what do we do, right? How do governments recover? How do scientific organizations recover? How does it shape the way that, you know, families are relating to the state? And so it's a different kind of project, but it has, you know, there are definitely continuities from the previous project.
Oh, wow. Congratulations on your book, Cybernetic Revolutionaries, that you mentioned in the beginning there. That sounds so cool. And that's really exciting to have completed that project. We'll have a link to it in the show notes for our listeners to check out. And what a fascinating research trajectory overall. Now, onto something a bit more specific. Can you tell us a little bit about interdisciplinary projects and what makes them unique, challenging, and special?
Yeah, so I would say probably the same thing, right? What makes it special is what also makes it challenging. And I think that, you know, if you're committed to working in more than one field, or if at some point you decide you want to switch fields or broaden the audience that you're speaking to, you're kind of going to have to start over in a way. You're going to have to, you know, start as someone who doesn't know very much, you know, as someone who, because you don't know very much, you have a lot to learn. And because you have a lot to learn, you're going to have to, you know, count not only on your own labors to navigate that learning curve, but also on the generosity of others who might wish to help you along the way. So, you know, you have to count on their willingness to help you, but that also means you also have to be able to ask, which can also, you know, kind of show that you don't know in the course of having to ask. So, you know, I would say that over the years, I've become comfortable not knowing and kind of walking into spaces saying, this isn't my area. Everybody here, you know, or most of the people here know more about this than I do. So I'm just going to listen. I'm going to listen. I'm going to read. I'm going to learn. I'm going to ask questions. And that may take time. It may take time before I feel that I actually belong or feel comfortable or can contribute to, you know, to this community in any way. So, you know, I find that to be something that is special, to be able to grow your community. You know, it's something that also takes more time. You know, when you're doing that, you're not necessarily publishing. You know, you're learning. And, you know, it also can be challenging.
Yeah, this is great. Especially the points about broadening our intellectual communities and how the challenge is what makes interdisciplinary projects so special. So now, thinking about those interdisciplinary projects, let's hear from our graduate student panel. What did they think about interdisciplinary projects?
I'm mostly a bench scientist. It does take place at the beginning of my research at field sites. And my lab is actually really unique because our work is what's called translational, or meaning that the research that we do isn't just to define something in biology or define something in the context of the disease, but also to ultimately inform a therapeutic or inform a policy or inform something on the actual disease and how individuals who are living with the disease then live their life. And so my work is probably like a nexus of what's called epidemiology, which is understanding the course of a disease in a population, and understanding the determinants of that disease in that population. So you know, a socioeconomic level, like leading to disparities. Does race play a role in how the disease occurs in a population, and different questions like that? So that's part of my research. Then it's the very basic parasitology, which is understanding and characterizing aspects of a parasite. And so that's very much more like molecular and cellular. And then my end product of my thesis is hopefully a vaccine candidate. And so that is way more translational. That goes into using animal models and understanding more about the vaccine and its effect in an actual living system. And so because my work is very cross-disciplinary in that nature, that you need to like draw on different things at different stages in my project, I think that for me, it's been very important to understand the sort of nature of the research that I do, in that, yes, I work with samples, but those samples are, you know, of human origin, and there are people at the start of this project, there were individuals enrolled in a study, and understanding that it's an extreme privilege to work with human samples and have individuals sort of want to partake in this study and want to partake in this research. And that at the end of the day, we owe something back to this community, and that we owe something back to these people, because we're not simply finding out, you know, aspects of the disease from a curiosity standpoint, but also because, as I said before, there's a critical need for a vaccine, or there's a critical need for a therapeutic. And so we need to make sure that we use our resources and our time wisely, because, you know, this disease is having a very big impact on individuals. That's how my research works, in a very cross-disciplinary, collaborative way.
Interdisciplinary studies, I think, is so important, because I think it really allows for more innovative work. I think it allows us to kind of like break out of these like disciplinary bounds that we've kind of structured ourselves within.
I would say almost honestly, all of my projects are pretty interdisciplinary. Like our lab works with like a lot of clinicians, but also industry as well. So I can give, I guess, a specific project. This one I'm working on now is making a device that can take RNA from blood, but it's very like low volumes of blood, so like microliters. And you're able to take that out using the device and then take from there the RNA to sequence it. So that's like helpful for like diseases. So like I'll say HIV, for example. And so the next phase of that, so that was like the engineering part of it, you know, making the device, doing all the testing, et cetera. So then the next part of that would be going to like, what's the word? I'll say launch it in a hospital laboratory. So going with a clinician, going to use some real patient samples and test it in actually like an environment where it would be used. And so I am trying to work on that next phase right now of getting it to be used in a different country. So that's kind of like where I guess my main interdisciplinary aspects are, just like in general, that's kind of how all my projects are, clinician and like laboratories, like bridging that gap. And I think the public health comes in, or I know the public health comes in, because I'm able to also look at it from the user perspective. So going and asking them, okay, what do you think of this? And putting that more like, and look, asking those questions in more of a systematic way. So I think what makes the project special is being able to look at a problem from multiple perspectives. So the person that's developing the device, but then also the person who's like implementing it into that laboratory or whatever, then making sure that the people that are using it are also considered and thought of in the whole process.
For me, in one of my first paper that I worked on, it could have fallen into sociology or social psychology. However, what each discipline was interested in was substantively different. So sociology was more the key outcome variable was depressive symptoms. And so social psychology was going to be really interested in the nuance of this mental health, you know, measure. Sociology was going to be really interested in the social patterns, right? Not so much the distinction between, you know, this integer and that integer, but in, you know, who it is that is experiencing X or Y. And so I had to really investigate, you know, in myself, what I was interested in. And what ended up happening is I brought in theory from social psychology And I pitched this research question as a theory test because there were two competing theories. But it was ultimately a sociological contribution about the kind of impact of inequality, right? Meeting your occupational goals or not having the ability to get there. I have to say I've done a little bit less interdisciplinary work since then. I may have dated around, but like once I settled down, I really settled down and I've settled down with sociology. But in graduate students, you know, within the department, I think some of the most interesting projects, yours to be one, it come from people who have very different backgrounds. And so they bring this very special way of thinking into the sociology discipline. And so there's just a fundamentally different way to think about theory that I find really challenging and really engaging, but also with methods.
Now, as always, another great round of thoughtful reflections from our graduate student panelists. In order, the students you heard there were Amanda Ruiz, a pathobiology student at Brown University, Dana Ahern, a feminist studies scholar at UCSB, Kiara Lee, biomedical engineering student at Brown University, and Kristen Zock, a sociology PhD student here at BU.
Matt, I was wondering, actually, I know how interdisciplinary work fits into my field and my research, but what about you? Who or what do you see yourself partnering with or collaborating with to reach your research goals as someone who's interested in robotics and engineering?
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't put me on the spot on this one. I honestly don't know yet. I'll likely be collaborating with other engineers, like in systems or mechanical engineering, on the controls and hardware questions, and probably with computer scientists to refine and optimize my algorithms. Beyond that, though, I am just not sure. You know, I'm interested in the economic and societal implications of robots replacing people in like low wage or repetitive work. But I don't know what that collaboration with economists or social scientists would even look like. It's definitely something I want to explore, but when I look around, I don't see a lot of collaboration happening outside of engineering and computer science. I mean, with the exception of medical robotics, where there's a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration, but that's really not my focus area. Clearly, I'm going to have to put some effort into figuring out those collaborations, I guess.
That was great. Just a quick plug for some BU programs, actually. I highly recommend the Center for Innovation and Social Science, the Computing and Data Sciences Department, the Program for Computational Humanities, Arts and Social Sciences, the Justice Media Collab, and BU Spark. I've actually been fortunate to work with BU Spark, where diligent computer science undergraduates are paired with community partners, including grad students and faculty at BU, to work on unique projects. So for me, I was studying constructions of opioid use and substance use disorder or addiction, and the team that I work with scraped over 8,000 GoFundMe campaigns from 2010 to 2020 to identify trends in constructions of drug use and addiction over time in the United States. It's a fascinating learning experience for everyone involved and a truly useful tool to practically promote interdisciplinary scholarship at BU. And in that vein, Dr. Medina, what do you think? How do you navigate cross-disciplinary research conversations and scholarship?
So it's not something that, you know, typically you can do on your own. But, you know, for this current project that I'm doing, it became very clear to me that I needed to know about law and I needed to know about human rights law. And I needed to know about the way that, you know, courts and legal documents and, you know, the science and the context of law, how does that all work? So I ended up doing a one-year master's degree at Yale Law School in studies of law. So, you know, kind of taking that year to retrain, you know, in essence to be a 1L, a first-year law student, which goes back to that thing of, you know, the challenges, but what is special, right? So being a 1L law student, you know, isn't easy, but to be able to learn something like that, you know, where you don't have to worry about getting a clerkship or you don't have to worry about getting a job, you can just kind of be engaged in the intellectual project. That's incredibly special. It depends on the project and the kind of knowledge that I've needed along the way. I would say for this most recent project, I also had the opportunity to take a short course at Mercyhurst University on identifying trauma in human remains. So learning more about forensic anthropology along the way, you know, certainly what I know is just a sliver of what practitioners know, but, you know, getting enough to know about the topic that I'm writing about and, you know, in a somewhat informed way. So yeah, it's kind of about what you need in order to produce a piece of scholarship that you deem rigorous. And, you know, for me, in order to produce a piece of scholarship that I deem rigorous, I need to know about the science. I need to know about the law. I need to know about the history. And so that takes, you know, particular investments of time. And also, you know, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I would say there's also a pitfall with this, right? So when you're an interdisciplinary scholar, you know, the pitfall is that, you know, you kind of know a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, right? Or maybe you have like your one tool and you kind of go from field to field to field to field. You know, what I tell my students and what I tell myself is that, you know, if you want to speak to more than one community, and, you know, as I say, I identify primarily as a historian of technology and a historian of Latin America, the scholarship has to be rigorous, right? And in order for it to be rigorous, it takes time, and you need to get to know that community, and you need to kind of know the conversations that are going on in that community, and you need to be able to make a contribution, hopefully, you know, to that community. You know, the it has to be real. So I would say, you know, yes, it's great to kind of do the traveling, but, you know, there is a pitfall that people can fall into along the way.
Yeah, so many good points there, especially about the breadth and depth needed to be a rigorous interdisciplinary scholar. Given the many different differences, we'll say, across disciplines, do you have any tips or best practices regarding interdisciplinary research?
I wouldn't say that this is limited to working across disciplines, but something that it took me a while to fully embrace is to recognize how much that writing is part of the research process. And so I think, you know, when I first started in grad school, you know, I don't know if it was a science model that I had in my head or where I picked it up, but I think it's a common conception that you do the research and then you write up your results. And when you write up your results, you know, after that, you know, you maybe read it over, make sure there are no typos, that it looks clean, and then you're done. And in the kind of work that I do, it just doesn't work like that. You know, the writing process is part of the analysis process, and the rewriting process is also part of the analysis process and the clarification process, and just really having an appreciation for the rewrite, for the edits, you know, and that writing is research. I always say that writing is research. So yes, that's not unique to interdisciplinary scholars, but, you know, I think that might be something that graduate students, especially graduate students that are first starting out, may not appreciate fully.
Absolutely. It's such a good point. Definitely need to work on my memoing during analysis, and that's a helpful reminder. Writing is research, and it's not a totally discrete stage. And next, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit more about novel data and method sources for interdisciplinary projects. Do you have any thoughts on this?
This trend towards interdisciplinary research is really exciting. So the kinds of questions that, you know, when I was starting my academic career, or the kinds of programs, you know, that I would have been interested in, you know, applying to as a graduate student just didn't exist. And now, you know, if you're interested in studying the social aspects of technology, there are just so many programs, wonderful programs, that you can choose from. And it is possible to learn different methods within that program to help you do that. So I think that's a wonderful shift within academia. You know, still there still can be pitfalls because people still like their disciplines. And you still can be like held to the expectation of a particular discipline, you know, so you have to be a little bit strategic, but I think that's a great development. In terms of novel sources, you know, I'm at MIT, so, you know, my perspective might be a little bit, I don't know, it might not be what's true everywhere. But a number of the graduate students here, you know, even though they're in a department that uses, you know, methods from the humanities and social sciences to study science and technology, a number of the students here also are able to use computational methods. They're able to work in labs in other parts of campus and, you know, not not studying those labs, but being, you know, active participants in those labs. So I'm thinking of students that perhaps are in like the computer science and artificial intelligence lab, and, you know, bringing their knowledge of social aspects of technology to the kinds of technical work that's being done. I think that's super cool. You know, and I think it's great that within a university, more and more you can do that kind of work. You know, there's a unit on campus here that's looking at, you know, social and ethical and responsible computing, you know, is kind of an umbrella where people who are coming from, you know, whether it's philosophy or history or artificial intelligence, you know, can come and think about those kinds of problems, hopefully to create better systems.
And while we're generally familiar with interviews, archival research, media analysis, and so on, which are often in interdisciplinary studies, can you tell us about the relationship of new sources of data, like big data and the data sciences, and how that relates to your work?
I'm so glad you asked me. I teach a course on data and society. And so I do think about, you know, data science, or just even how we're thinking about data or how understandings of data have changed over time. And, you know, at least anecdotally, what I've seen is within the past 10 years, the term data has just taken on a whole other kind of significance. You know, we can push the edges, like maybe like 12, 15 years, but, you know, really it's a relatively recent phenomenon, to the extent that, you know, now I, as a historian, when I apply for an NSF grant, I turn in a data management plan. So, you know, my source materials are now likened to data. And, you know, across the board, you know, all researchers, whatever their research product is, it is under the term data. So I think there are different ways that we can look at that. We can look at it as, oh, we all have data, right? We all have lots and lots of data. And I think, you know, that preference for the term data is also, you know, it's coming about because of the changes in computational ability that have taken place in the past, you know, 10 to 15 years, in terms of our abilities to collect, to analyze, to monetize data on a very, very large scale. So I think because of that, data has, you know, it's got a good deal of power. And so, you know, the term is kind of, it's in the world. And so we're all now data collectors, data managers, data analyzers. So sure, in that way, you know, it has become kind of homogenizing, and we all collect data, and we all have, you know, related concerns about that data. We want to keep it safe. We want to keep it private. We want to make sure that we, you know, if we have research subjects, we want to make sure that, you know, we honor their informed consent, and, you know, we honor their dignity, and we honor their privacy. And so, you know, we all do share those kinds of concerns. Where I start to think that perhaps data is a universalizing term, perhaps, you know, isn't as universally applicable. When I think of my own data, you know, if I was not, you know, told to frame it in that way, I would probably say, oh, my documents, or, oh, my interviews, my recorded interviews, my interview transcripts. And I, you know, and I think that kind of shift from data to interview, you know, or data to document, I mean, it gives you, it's a different frame, right? So right away, if you're going from data to interview, I mean, you're foregrounding the person, and you're foregrounding their story, and you're foregrounding the kinds of questions that you can ask of what you've collected in the course of your research, because the research questions aren't going to be the same. You know, so for example, we do I co-teach a data and society course with a member of urban studies and planning who's a data scientist. And so, you know, one of the exercises we ask the students to do is we ask them to build their own data set of, you know, of a daily activity that they have. And so, you know, I remember one of our students, you know, collected this data set using his cell phone of, you know, the amount of time he spent, you know, chatting or FaceTiming with his girlfriend. And so, you know, he could see very clearly that between this hour and this hour, you know, is when he tended to talk to his girlfriend. And, you know, so he had the time, he had the duration, and from that he could see certain patterns, you know, so maybe he should have gotten more sleep, maybe, you know, certain patterns were able to come out of that. But we don't know, you know, about the kind of comfort or anxiety that he feels in those conversations. We don't know about how that's shaping his experience as an MIT student. Right, there are all these other kinds of questions that we can't get at from that kind of data. So yeah, I think it's a great question and is very much a reflection of where we are today in the data-driven world.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I've been thinking about a lot is ethics in technology and our data sets. You know, we have all these huge data sets now and they're turned into new AI models seemingly every day. But something that we're seeing is that these models, these AI models, can very easily be inherently racist or sexist or classist. And I would really like to get your thoughts on how we can combat those challenges.
My sense is that that the message has gotten out, you know, that students know that many of these systems are built off of data sets. And that, you know, data sets are social, that they're created by people in particular moments based on what's available to people in those particular moments. And so therefore, the data sets themselves, you know, they reflect the social context of their time, you know, and there have been some very well known examples, you know, most notably in facial recognition and racial bias in facial recognition, but also in voice recognition, you know, the accent discrimination. So I think the message is getting out in terms of data sets not being as objective or universal as one might hope. But there's a difference between knowing that, you know, and then, you know, actually when you have to build something at the end of the day. I even think, you know, if you have to build a data set of your life, you start to see some of the tough decisions that you have to make along the way in terms of what you can access, like what is possible and what, you know, you can't access. So therefore is not going to be part of that data set. So I think that there are, you know, exercises like that, you know, to try to make that visible. It's a big issue and it's a big problem. Again, to go back to these questions about technologies and their interactions with society and the kinds of societies that we are building, it's a big issue because the data sets that have these problems continue to be reused. They're brought back and they're reused again. And it's not only about the biases, it's also about consent. You know, what did people actually consent? I can give you an example, you know, a personal example. My son is at sleepaway camp. And, you know, there is an app that the camp is using for uploading photos, but I could also, if I so chose, I could upload my son's picture and they could do facial recognition to pick out his photo from, you know, the other photos that are being uploaded. And so for me, as somebody who works in this space and who thinks about these issues, how can I give informed consent to that? Right, when I don't know how those pictures or you know, tagging this, how it might be used in the future. So it is, or how that data set might be, you know, of all the, you know, the tagged pictures that have been uploaded, how it might be used in the future. So it's tough, but hopefully, you know, teaching these kinds of classes will help.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for sharing that thought. And before we let you go, we were hoping you'd tell us a bit more about what you see as the future of interdisciplinary research and academia in general. What are your thoughts there?
Unfortunately, programs that are interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, that are critical, that are dealing with issues of race and gender, they have had to struggle, you know, sometimes, you know, just to continue to exist, to continue to have their funding line. Or spaces here, you know, the Program for Science, Technology, and Society. From what I understand, in the earlier days, this program was also pretty precarious, as a transdisciplinary space and, you know, as a space where scholars were sometimes critical of technology. So, you know, I agree that it's important to have these spaces. It's important to have this kind of scholarship. And I would also broaden it out, not as a way to move our eyes or the focus from, you know, spaces like the ones you're naming, whether it's about gender or race or indigeneity or disability or, you know, however, you know, we're thinking more broadly. We're thinking more broadly about the world and the kinds of societies that we want to build. But I mean, we also see it about the humanities more broadly. I argue and fully believe that, you know, in the academy, we need to do whatever we can to protect and preserve the humanities. because we are getting views from, I mean, how do you understand how different people experience the world? I mean, that's through the humanities. Like, how do you understand the kinds of challenges and how people confront that? Or how people have, I don't know, how they've created those challenges and then designed solutions for them and like what happened to them? Or, you know, read a document critically. All of this is, you know, coming out of the humanities, how people have found hope, you know, in moments that are really dark. So yes, to just echo my support for the kinds of programs that you mentioned for interdisciplinary spaces, which universities don't always know what to do with. They don't know what to do with also when it comes to tenure decisions, because tenure often is based around your excellence in a discipline and getting letter writers from a discipline. So even at a structural level, that can be challenging, but also from a broader level about the importance of humanities and humanities-oriented research, even of areas such as science and technology.
Yes, as a social scientist, I absolutely agree. We have to protect the humanities. So much generative work comes from the humanities that is often under-supported. And for those of us in traditionally less vulnerable disciplines like STEM and the social sciences, we really need to do what we can to support our peers and the important research that they're generating. Is there anything else that you want to add about the future of interdisciplinary studies?
At least in my field, so I'll say history of computing is one of the fields that I move in. I think that it is an incredibly exciting place to be right now. I mean, there's just a whole new lines of scholarship, you know, that have been, you know, so people have been interested in gender, you know, before, but more fascinating scholarship on gender, race, disability, you know, ethnicity. You know, I remember, you know, way back in the day, people were like, oh, race and computing, you know, what, there's no, you know, that doesn't matter. And, you know, to look at the scholarship now, it's like, of course it matters. Of course it does. You know, and that's been, you know, all of the new work that has come out recently, which has shown us, you know, about racial bias in computing and how it matters in very, very important ways. There's new scholarship that's coming out about computing all over the world. So one of the things that I've wanted to see is, you know, understanding computing as a global phenomena. And I think we're getting there. There's a symposium taking place right now on the history of computing in Latin America that's bringing researchers in different Latin American countries together, you know, to bring Latin American histories, you know, to have them be written and shared and put out into the world, which is wonderful. And then to go to the point of interdisciplinarity, you know, seeing people who are coming not out of, you know, history programs or history of science programs, but maybe out of media studies or, you know, related fields who have different, you know, bodies of literature or theories that they might draw from, bringing that in ways that enrich the field. So, you know, I would say it's an exciting moment to be a historian of computing.
Wow, yeah, that was really great. That sounds like we have a lot to look forward to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me and letting me share my thoughts with your audience.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Medina, and looking forward to discussing research and disseminating research to a broader audience during our next episode. As always, for more information on our guests and the Vitamin PhD podcasts, please check out our show notes. Talk soon.